You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Our country marked 400,000 deaths from the coronavirus, exactly 1 year to the day since the first case was diagnosed in our country. And more than 128,000 of those cases and more than 1,600 deaths have happened right here in Idaho. Now, here's the good news. Almost 11,000 Idahoans have received their vaccination so far. So joining us today to talk more about all of this and where we are when it comes to the pandemic are our medical experts, Dr. Rob Cavanaugh, St. Luke's Executive Medical Director, and Dr. Andrew Southard, Emergency Medical Director at St. Alphonsus. Dr. Pate had a prior commitment today and cannot join us. However, don't worry, he will be back next week. So if you've got a question for us, send it now, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Thank you for joining us today, both of you.
Thanks for having us.
So I really want to start with where we're at in the state right now. So Dr. Cavanaugh and Dr. Southard, I'll ask you the same question about Owls, but why don't we start with Luke's. What are you seeing at St. Luke's? Because what we've been hearing is that overall hospitalizations in Idaho are down, yet our numbers are up in ICUs.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Gemma. So we are seeing a decrease in our overall hospitalization. That's good. I think it's multifactorial. There are several things that are contributing to that. And one of the issues is that we're getting better and finding more comfort in being able to manage people at home. Mm. And so we're realizing who needs to be hospitalized and who doesn't. We also are using some new medicines that have been authorized for emergency use by the FDA that's helping to prevent hospitalizations, the monoclonal antibody that's available. And then thirdly, I would say we've got some mechanisms that help us to monitor patients outside the hospital that we call remote patient monitoring, where we send patients home with a pulse oximeter and other equipment that we can use to measure their vital signs at home so we can keep close tabs on them and feel more confident about letting them recover at home.
And then Dr. Southard, what about St. Alphonsus? Where is your organization at?
Yeah, I'd say that ours is similar to St. Luke's at the moment. We've seen a decrease in total hospitalizations throughout our whole system. From the emergency department standpoint, I'd say over the last 2 weeks, we're seeing probably fewer people coming in with COVID-like symptoms, although the people who are tend to be sicker, I would say longer in their duration, and often some of the older population, more of the comorbidities, so people with diabetes and COPD. And I agree, you know, we're sending home people more, I wouldn't say, I guess aggressively is one way of phrasing it, but we've kind of determined who we can send home safely with some of the home monitoring that we're doing and our COVID clinic. And so the people who we're admitting now are actually ending up staying a little bit longer because they're a little bit sicker. So that's been the general trend we have at St. Al's.
So I'm curious as to where we are in regards to, do both of you think that we've kind of come over a hump and our numbers should be going down? And I ask that because we're almost 3 weeks out from New Year's, from New Year's. We're almost 4 weeks out from Christmas. And we know that that really impacted the numbers, not just in Idaho, but across the country. So do you have confidence that we may be seeing numbers starting to drop? Because, you know, we still have issue in Idaho with people masking up and doing the things that we still need to be doing.
Yeah, Gemma, great question. I think it will continue to ebb and flow based on behaviors as well as dates that come up that cause people to get together and congregate. So I think we'll continue to see it sort of wax and wane. I don't know that we'll see a significant impact from the vaccine for a while because we're going to have to get a significant proportion of the population vaccinated in order to see that to lead to a significant reduction in the disease burden in our community. So I think we're just going to see this, you know, wave pattern of things going up and then coming back down over the next several months until we can widely distribute the vaccine.
And Dr. Southard, how are you feeling about where we are with the vaccine rollout in our state? Because it seems that we are getting the vaccine in arms quicker than some states are.
Yeah, I think that the vaccine distribution is obviously pretty complicated, and you know, simply getting the vaccine in your arm is like one small part of the whole distribution process, which is actually the more challenging aspect. But I'm pretty proud of how well Idaho has done. I know, depending on what group you're in, that may not be the sentiment you feel at the moment, but most of like the ICU and ER doctors and frontline staff, I mean, we had it within 48 hours, at least the first dose of it arriving in Idaho. And you know, we vaccinated, I think, 2,500 people yesterday at St. Al's or over the weekend.
So 2,500, wow.
Yeah, quite a few. And so we're getting it there. Capacity is increasing. And I think it's going really pretty well overall. And I know everyone, especially people over 65, really are looking forward to this, and we want to get to them as soon as possible. And I think that's coming in, you know, 2 weeks here around February. So I think we may not be the best in the country, but we're certainly in the top percent, in my opinion.
And Jen, well, I'd add, you know, we've never done this before. We've never been faced with hurry up and vaccinate the entire population as fast as you can. And so there's a lot of logistical challenges, and some of them have already been highlighted, that really lead to this is a major undertaking and not something that we've had to do in the past.
Right. It's different than other vaccines, that's for sure. And Dr. Kavanaugh, can we talk a little bit about maybe some of the issues? One, and I'd like you to talk a little bit, if you can, about MyChart, because when St. Luke's announced it was opening up vaccines to some people outside of your health system, people were told by some of your counterparts at Luke's that they needed to make an appointment on MyChart. That was the easiest way to do it. But you really do have to set up an account if you have not ever been a patient at St. Luke's.
True. So, you know, we have to figure out a way to do this in an orderly fashion. And that's the way that we've selected, is to do it by appointment based. What we don't want to do is just open it wide up and then have huge throngs of people show up and get frustrated at waiting hours and hours in line, or risk exposing each other potentially. And so what we have done is set up something that we think is going to be very well organized and methodical. And it will allow us also to match the supply with the demand. Mm-hmm. Now, we only get certain, you know, allocations of doses. And so what we don't want to do is have people show up and not have vaccine to distribute to them. So we're matching as we get doses in, we open up new appointments, and we just want to make sure that we're able to give doses to everyone that we've made an appointment with, and to do it in orderly fashion.
So before we take a break, I want to talk to both of you about these new variants of the virus that we're hearing about. Because there seems to be a lot of information coming at everyone about these, that these are more contagious, right? They're easier to spread, may not be any more deadly, you know, but however, that we could see more cases because of this. I'm curious if either of you are concerned about this. We know it hasn't been diagnosed in Idaho. I think that's fair to say that doesn't necessarily mean it's not here. Are you concerned? And also, how concerned should the general public be about this? Because honestly, this is just, you know, it's crushing to hear again about, well, here come the vaccines, but now we've got these new variants, right? Does that, you know what I'm saying? Like, it can be crushing to your soul, frankly.
Yeah, given this is Drew. I agree that it's almost like one step forward, two steps back sometimes. But this is the natural, you know, history of all viruses and to some degree bacteria. You know, on a large scale, the virus that's going to do the best is the one that's pretty infectious, but doesn't really kill its host. And so there's always going to be somewhat on a really large scale a tendency for viruses to mutate like that. But the best part about this is that even though all these mutations are going to occur, it's really going to be unusual for it to mutate out of the vaccine, at least right now. And so people can have some, I guess, reassurance in that. And that's been what we've seen so far, is the vaccine still remains effective against these. And so that's really a positive finding. I'm personally not too concerned about it yet. I know that even the data out of Europe is still a little confusing as to whether this strain is necessarily extremely more contagious, or if we just picked up that there was more people with it. And so I don't know that it's going to change much what we're doing here. It seems that the standard precautions we've been taking are effective against it as well. And so personally, I'm not as worried about these variants at this moment.
And Dr. Southard, one thing that you mentioned about, you know, that we know that the vaccines are working against these new variants. I was reading a medical article earlier today where they said that maybe there could be a little bit less efficacy with some of these new variants. However, when we have a 95% efficacy rate, that's not that much. I mean, is that a fair statement to make? Because that's a huge efficacy.
Yeah, and I think that people shouldn't be the efficacy rate of 95% is in a study, and it's not going. It would be usual for that to actually go down just in the general, once we start vaccinating the general population, only because vaccine trials have an inherent bias in them. There are people who, you know, want to get the vaccine, usually not as sick, and so when you open that up to a general population, your efficacy is probably going to go down a little bit just at baseline. Could it happen a little bit more with the new variants? Certainly possible. Again, like you said, we're starting at 95%. So even if we get down to 85%, that's still very good. There's still a lot of years that the flu vaccine isn't that high. So I think that all combines to a pretty good prognostic picture for the vaccine, even against these variants.
All right, we have quite a few questions, so I want to get to them. So Mac from Parma is asking that we hear reports of a new strain of the coronavirus being referred to as the UK version. Several instances of it being found in the US have been reported where the infected person has no travel history. So is it not plausible that the virus is independently undergoing identical mutations in numerous locations? So Dr. Southard, I know we hit on this a little bit before the break, but can you maybe talk about what we may know about this variant, or and how we could be impacted by that?
Yeah, sure. So I think the question here of whether this virus could have mutated similarly in two different continents, while I think that's, I guess, theoretically possible, it would be extremely unlikely. So I do think that the version that we have here in the US is the UK variant. It's probably more widespread than we recognize. It would be kind of like having, I don't know, the lottery Powerball and random numbers come up in two different countries at the same time. It's
okay. Really unlikely.
So, and I do think that there's also I believe it's another variant they've noticed as well. And these are usually changes to some of the proteins on the virus structure. Now, these are the only ones we've really identified. It should be noted the virus is probably mutating, you know, millions and millions and millions of times a day. And these are the only ones that become viable. Mm. Most times these mutations actually make the virus less contagious, or actually don't even let it continue to exist. So most of these are going to just go away. And the ones who make the virus a little bit more contagious, like we said before, are probably going to be the ones that are selected for. So other than kind of monitoring and watching it, this is the expected course of all viruses. And hopefully it won't turn into something that's more lethal. That would be the biggest issue. But at this point, again, it doesn't seem to be going that way.
I think that's a really good point to make, though, Dr. Southard, is that this is how viruses work, right? Is that they do mutate. And I don't like to compare the coronavirus to the flu because of all of the misinformation that has happened with that. However, that's also one of the reasons why we get a flu shot every year, is because it could change a bit, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's also why there's different flu efficacies of the vaccine. I mean, we're trying to get usually a couple of the more likely variants in there. But by the time that the vaccine gets produced and the flu per se, it can take quite a while. And so we're kind of choosing what we think is going to be going on, what the most likely strains are, you know, early in the development of the vaccine. It comes out 9 months later for the flu. And sometimes we're more accurate than other times. So that's why some of the years we see the vaccine efficacy of the flu being less than what it is in a previous year. So you're absolutely right. It happens all the time to flu as well.
Dr. Kavanaugh, Heather asks, we have three college students coming home soon. What precautions should my husband and I take to integrate them back into our family bubble? Should we ask them to get a COVID test and then quarantine until they get their results? What protocols do you suggest that we follow to be safe as they return home?
It's a really good question. Some of it would depend on the risk levels of the individuals. So, you know, their other medical problems that they have and their ages. And so it's tough to give just blanket advice. I would say, you know, the safest thing to do for sure would be to, get a COVID test and quarantine. Certainly, you know, if I would be careful asking about symptoms and exposure history and things like that, because many people can be asymptomatic. Other people can have very mild symptoms. So things that they don't really attribute that could make them infectious. And so certainly erring on the side of caution makes a lot of sense in avoiding contact. Certainly hand washing, as hard as it is, avoid, you know, hugging and things like that we know are likely to transmit the virus. But again, I think the response would depend on the particular situation.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Southern, Paul writes, should one get tested for COVID after a 14-day quarantine, even if you're not symptomatic?
So I guess it would really depend on what the indication they want to get tested for are or for is, but there's really no utility to it. If you've quarantined for 14 days, you're not having any symptoms, the chance of the test being positive is really low. And so I don't really see a lot of utility in that in and of itself. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Kavanaugh, Dixie has a question, and we've gotten questions like these in the past. She wants to know, is it safe for 8 family members from Idaho to fly to Hilton Head Island in South Carolina?
Safe is a relative term, right?
There's risk
in anything that we do. Again, it depends on the health status of the individuals. That would be one. And the other thing is, you know, I think that people can travel either by car or by air if they're careful. And so if they're wearing their mask the entire time, if they're very diligent about hand hygiene, if they avoid crowds, and the people can travel safely, relatively safely, as long as they're very diligent about the things that we know that prevent the spread of the virus.
Dr. Southern, Keith is writing in and he says, we have found that people's natural immunity to having had COVID-19 seems to be from a couple of weeks to 4 months. So he's curious, do we know how long your immunity lasts once you have both rounds of the COVID vaccine?
That's a great question. Unfortunately, don't. I mean, there's people doing some antibody studies currently, and it looks to be at least six months at this point. From what I understand and have read so far, that your viral antibody titers actually are increased greater after the immunization than they are actually from getting the actual COVID. Now, whether that pans out long term or not, it's kind of interesting, because usually we expect when someone gets the actual virus or actual bacteria to have more immunity than a vaccine. It doesn't seem to be the case currently in COVID, and why that is, we don't know. But it's unknown. And unfortunately, you know, the people who got the first round of vaccine ever in the test are currently being monitored. We'll know a little bit more, but I mean, they've only had it for 6 or 7 months total as well. So it's going to be hard to say how long.
Yeah. So I know we talked about this in an earlier segment regarding how many vaccines that we're administering per day here in Idaho. And Dr. Southern, you had mentioned that just at St. Alphonsus last weekend, 2,500 in a day. So Steve wrote in saying that we're actually going very slowly in getting people immunized. He says a typical day appears to just be 2,000 to 3,000 doses administered. So he wants to know, what can we do to accelerate the pace of the immunizations? And I'm curious from both of you, because when you said that number to me, Dr. Southern, I was like, wow, that's a lot more than I expected. Is there anything that we can do to speed this up? Or as both of you mentioned, this is new.
I think one other issue is you have to, Idaho, we have a pretty small population. So when you hear, you'll probably hear numbers like 10, 20,000 people being given vaccines, and maybe NFL stadiums or something like that, and mm-hmm. I think Arizona. their population is much, much larger and more dense. And so, you know, if you divide, you know, how many vaccines we're giving per population in Idaho, it's actually still pretty high. I do think that the technology aspect, like Dr. Kavanaugh mentioned about having to register people, is definitely challenging. The large healthcare systems like St. Al's and St. Luke's are able to use some of their previous existing appointment information to be able to do it. But it's that aspect of getting it, of preparing the vaccines for the number of people who are coming in that day, is actually very challenging. And I know that there was just some grant money, I believe this last week, that came out to help hospitals do that. It's a massive IT lift. And to other people's point, we don't want to waste vaccine. And so we have to know how many people are coming in the next morning, the day before, and even, you know, to the hour they're coming in. That's much more challenging to do than having, you know, a bunch of flu vaccine and being able to store and pull what we needed. And also knowing how many people are ultimately going to take it. That's been a little bit more challenging, I think, than recognize as a new vaccine. And, you know, is it going to be 60% of the population that wants it, or 90%? And 30% different is thousands and thousands of doses. Mm-hmm. So those are the challenges, and they're slowly being overcome.
And Dr. Kavanaugh, there is word that we could have even more vaccines coming on board. Johnson & Johnson and I believe AstraZeneca are slowly in the process of getting FDA approval. How, if we then have like four vaccines available, does that, yes, it speeds up the process, but does it also potentially make it more complicated?
For sure. It absolutely could. And remember, you know, the Pfizer vaccine has to be stored at negative 70 degrees. And then we have to thaw it out, reconstitute it, and give it. So that's part of the complexity and following all the appropriate protocols based on the manufacturer of the vaccine and the vendor, that does add complexity. It also adds supply. And so we'll need to be working with our other healthcare partners and pharmacies and other folks across the state to effectively distribute it throughout the population. So yes, it does add complexity. It will increase the supply, which is one of the limiting factors that we have, right? We can't give out vaccine that we don't have.
Right.
I'd add on to what Dr. Southern was talking about, in that, you know, when we do give the vaccine, we want to make it safe for everyone. So we want to ask screening questions. We don't want to give it to someone who's had COVID recently. We don't want to give it to someone who's had a vaccine recently. We don't want to give it to someone who's had a severe reaction to a vaccine. So we're taking precautions to make sure that we give it safely. We want to make sure that everyone's socially distanced. We clean the rooms afterwards. There's a lot of behind the scenes things that people aren't appreciating likely that leads to the limitation in the number of vaccines that we can give out daily. I would share at St. Luke's, we've given out 17,000 vaccines. 13,500 were the initial and 3,500 were boosters. So we feel good about the progress we're making. We're not where we want to be, but we do feel good about the rate that we are increasing the distribution.
Our panel today, Dr. Rob Kavanaugh, St. Luke's Executive Medical Director, and Dr. Andrew Southard, Emergency Medical Director at St. Alphonsus. Should note, Dr. Pate had a prior commitment. He will be back with us next week, though. So we mentioned this a little bit about vaccines before the break. So, Dr. Kavanaugh, I want to go back to you because Jolene just wrote in and she asks, what is the safety of the vaccine for patients with severe food allergies? Would it be advisable for them to take Benadryl in advance?
Good question. What we do know is that there's an increased risk for people who have had a severe reaction to vaccines previously, not necessarily food allergies. Now, you know, we've had a very small number of people have reactions that we had to treat. Having something like Benadryl on hand would be smart in someone who's had severe allergic reactions in the past, and our team is ready to treat people. We've got epinephrine standing by, and that's why we make people hang around for 15 minutes after they've been vaccinated in order to ensure that they're not having a severe reaction.
And Dr. Kavanaugh, that also goes back to why this takes longer, right? It's not like when you get your flu shot, you go in, you know, even to the pharmacy, they give you the shot and you leave. I mean, you do have to wait around.
That's right. That's right. And we're wanting, like I talked about before, we want to do this safely as we possibly can. We can't avoid every single reaction that might occur, but we can be there ready to treat someone if they do have a severe reaction.
So this goes also into John's question, Dr. Southard. He wants to know, he says, you know, at first there was news of a couple of people who had a bad reaction from the vaccine. Now that more people are being vaccinated, do we have any more data when it comes to how people are reacting to this?
I think the most recent number I saw was about 1 in 100,000 is having some sort of reaction, Gemma, and that would be a more significant anaphylactic type reaction. Mm. That's about on par with most vaccinations out there. We are seeing occasional reactions. Most of them are very mild, just kind of require just a little bit of medication, but not unexpected, nothing, I guess, out of the ordinary. It may seem like you hear more about them. I think it's going to be a little bit more on everyone's radar. And again, one of those things, you know, you give 2,500 vaccinations in a weekend. We're just not used to doing that. Even in, you know, in the flu season, we typically give probably a couple hundred a week in the community. So when you're giving thousands and thousands, they're going to seem like they're more prevalent, but the absolute percent is probably actually still very low.
Dr. Cavanaugh, Diane wants to know, what are the vaccination protocols for those highly vulnerable, very elderly people in their own homes? Not just when, but how will they get this vaccine if they are homebound?
Yeah, one of the challenges that we're facing to get this out to everyone, right? So that's something that we're working through, figuring out how to disperse this widely. And I don't know that we've come around exactly how to do that effectively. I would say that they're certainly in the high-risk category, and we want them to get the vaccine. I think that it's critical that they do get it, and figuring out all the logistical details is part of the complexity.
Dr. Southard, Sean has this question. He says, I'd like to know what it is about being a diabetic that makes COVID-19 potentially more serious for people.
Sure. It's a little bit complex, just because being a diabetic or having other health conditions, it's not just COVID-19, it's at risk for everything. And you know, diabetes specifically is a disease of kind of the microvasculature. It affects your heart, it affects the way your immune response is. So specifically for COVID-19, those are all going to have an effect. And so that particularly is complicated by the fact that a lot of people have multiple comorbidities. So a lot of times you have diabetes, also high blood pressure. And so I think it's more of a global picture of your health that has an impact on COVID-19 rather than any one disease entity. And if you have diabetes or other comorbidities, you're just a little more susceptible to all viruses and to have a worse outcome for any disease process.
So Lara has a question, and she says, I know several families or even roommate situations or couples where only one person gets tested and the rest of the group, even if they're symptomatic, do not get tested. So this is her question. Do they get counted in the probable column, or are these untracked?
I would say that if they're not tested, they're likely not counted, because there's no good way to track that. Just the fact that they have people that they live, you know, live with or cohabitate with. So I believe that we are only counting people who have tested positive.
Mm. Go ahead, Dr. Southard.
Yeah, that's always a problem with these kind of large populations, as I'm sure we've all heard of or know. Someone's family member tests positive and they get symptoms, and they just kind of assume that they have COVID-19, and they probably are correct, but they may not seek healthcare or a test to confirm it. Mm.
And then a follow-up that Laura had on that was, could you speak on the number of people, and I mean, I think, you know, who knows if we know this, who are sick with COVID symptoms, yet they're not getting tested because they don't want to have to quarantine, or maybe they don't want to have to miss work or school. Are we seeing a lot of that within our community? Or frankly, you can't even track something like that, I would think. Dr. Cavanaugh?
Yeah, it's impossible to measure, you know, who's not getting tested or who's not reporting. What I think we can be confident in saying is that the numbers that we see are actually underestimating the actual disease burden in the community, right? Because we know that there are people who have, you know, little or no symptoms who actually have COVID-19. And there's also people who get symptoms who just assume they've got it. They quarantine, they stay home, they do whatever, and they never get officially tested. So we're not counting them. So as we see the numbers across, you know, the country and across Idaho, we can be confident in saying that's an underestimation of the actual number of cases.
Dr. Southard, Kathy just sent this email, and she says, my 30-year-old son got the Moderna vaccine on December 31st, and then 2 days later started feeling poorly. He got tested for COVID January 2nd. He was positive on a PCR test. His symptoms are completely resolved now. So should he have his booster at this time?
Oh, good question. I think the right answer is probably not. I'd probably wait for the 90 days. He unfortunately was probably in the window either of pre-symptoms when he first got it or just got it right afterwards. So he should have immunity through getting the disease process itself, COVID, for, you know, up to 90 days or so. And we do worry that people who have had the COVID virus actually get a pretty healthy immune response. And so giving them a vaccine could have a pretty significant effect on them. So I would wait until about 90 days after his 14 days of COVID.
And then Andy had this question, and Dr. Southard, I'll give it to you because he received his first dose of the Moderna vaccine this past Saturday at St. Alphonsus in Nampa. So he said at the time he was scheduled for the second dose. And he says he read that the Moderna vaccine requires a 28-day period between shots. He says, but he was scheduled 26 days out. Is this shorter waiting period leading to lesser effectiveness?
No, it shouldn't be. And there, I think the recommendation was 21 to 30 days. It's roughly 30 days. And so having 24, 48 hours on either side is not going to really affect the vaccine. I wouldn't be surprised in the future if we identify even greater lengths of time. This was just how it came out on the first recommendation from the manufacturer. But the scheduling issues around that are minimal compared to what the vaccine efficiency is. And so I wouldn't have any concerns about that.
But it's critically important to get that second dose.
Absolutely, yeah. We know that after the first dose, at least in the Pfizer vaccine, looked to be about 50% of people developed some sort of antibody, but up to 95% after the second one. So you definitely want to get the second shot.
Dr. Kevin L. Todd is writing in and he says, we have friends traveling from out of state to visit. They had COVID this fall. They will be flying here. Does their immunity protect them from getting it again, or could they carry it to us?
So the carrier question is unanswered. Could they be a carrier, not have symptoms and bring it? That's certainly possible. We don't necessarily know the answer to that. They wouldn't have it left over from when their infection was several months ago. There have been reported cases of people getting COVID more than once. It's not common at all. There's probably some extenuating circumstances behind that. And so if the friends who are visiting have all had COVID, I would say that the chances of them infecting their guests or their hosts are pretty low.
Dr. Southern, Tom has a question. He says, and we had mentioned this, that we're seeing these large vaccination sites in states with large populations, like, for example, in football stadiums, like we've seen like in Arizona and in Florida. So Tom wants to know if there are plans to set up mass vaccination sites in Idaho. But I do go back to your point of the difference in population. I mean, for example, I lived in Florida for 2 years quite a while ago, and the county I lived in had more people than the state of Idaho has.
Right, yeah. I have not heard of any large areas being set up at this point. I mean, Ada County, I think, is roughly around 400,000 or 500,000 people. And, you know, again, a place like Arizona or Phoenix is probably 20 million. So I think just having St. Luke's and St. Al's, even in the large auditoriums we're doing it, is probably on the same scale as having an NFL stadium, as strange as that may sound for the population differences.
Dr. Kavanaugh, you're getting all the travel questions today. But Dave is writing in and he says, after he completes the vaccine regimen, how safe would it be to take an international trip that would include time on a cruise ship? But he wouldn't be doing this until the fall of 2021. And man, that seems like a long time from now.
Lots of different elements to that question. So by the fall of 2021, if we are effective in getting a significant portion of the population vaccinated, this may be a very different conversation. We hope that the disease burden in the community will be significantly decreased, and we will be moving back, you know, more towards what we would consider to be, you know, our normal life. If someone's been fully vaccinated, in other words, they've received the primer and the booster, their chances of you know, something bad happening to them from COVID is exceedingly low. And so, you know, travel for that individual is probably going to be pretty safe for them. So I would have very little hesitation after being fully vaccinated.
But with that being said, Dr. Kavanaugh, it's still so important, at least right now, and I would assume for the next few months at a minimum, that even if you're vaccinated, fully vaccinated, you still have to follow the protocols that we've been following, even if you haven't been vaccinated, correct?
Absolutely. There's a question out there, you know, is the Pfizer vaccine so effective that it would prevent you from even being a carrier, meaning that you're not going to get infected by COVID, but you could potentially transmit it from one person to the other? That question hasn't been answered. And so I think, you know, as tired as we are of all of the things that we've had to do, socially distance, wear a mask, wash our hands frequently, we need to continue to be diligent in maintaining those practices, at least for the next several months. And it could mean people's lives. It could mean that we are decreasing the number of people who get infected and turn out some of them have severe infections, and some of them unfortunately die. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, for the next several months, we just need to keep doing what we're doing until we can vaccinate a significant portion of the population.
I don't mean for this to sound trite, but I will tell you, I think one of the benefits of wearing a mask in the winter in Idaho is, honestly, you're warmer when you have to be outside. I mean, truly, like but at the same time, you know, it's also, I think, becoming natural in the sense that if you've been following these protocols, it's just normal. I still have to tell my kids when I pick them up from school to take their mask off when they get in the car.
Yeah, and I'd add, Gemma, that, you know, what we're doing for COVID is equally as effective against the flu. And
right.
So we are going to see, and we are seeing, fewer cases of flu because, again, these measures are effective against that as well. So, you know, the unintended consequences is we're seeing fewer flu cases.
So we're seeing a lot of questions coming in regards to how to find out when and where and how you get the vaccine. And Dr. Southard, this has been there's a lot of frustration out there in regards to that. And I know that there was supposed to be a website that was coming up yesterday. They've had a couple of little glitches with it, so it's not ready yet. But that is supposed to streamline the process here in Idaho. But until then, I mean, what is the easiest way for someone to find out if, when, and where they can get the vaccine?
Sure. I think I would point them to the district health page of the county they're located in. So for the Boise residents, it's going to be, you know, Central District Health. They have a tier system there on the website that's going to say when the state is going to authorize the distributors, such as St. Al's, St. Luke's, to give them to those tier systems. And then obviously the hospitals are working really hard to get that IT platform built out. And I believe, at least from the St. Alphonsus standpoint, we should be able to start taking some of those over 65s in about a week. And it will be through the website. I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if there are some hiccups with it. Like you said, it's just, this is a massive effort, and they're trying to get all that appointment scheduling for multiple hospital sites and for thousands of people at the same time. But mm-hmm. that's how I would approach at this point.
Before I let the two of you go, I'm curious to know, you know, here we are a year into the first case being diagnosed in the country. March 13th was the first day there was a diagnosed case in the state of Idaho. So, you know, we've been in this really for a year. What are your thoughts? And I'll start with you, Dr. Kavanaugh. Like, what are you most concerned with still right now? But at the same time, it does feel like there's at least some light at the end of this tunnel.
Yeah, I'm encouraged by the news that we're seeing from the vaccines and the efficacy of it, having new vaccines come on board and be available, and the distribution of the vaccines across the country. I'm most concerned about the 400,000 people that we've lost.
Yeah.
And I just so lament that I believe that many of them at least were preventable had we had a more robust plan, and if we were able to more effectively adhere to the measures that we know work. And so that's just heartbreaking.
Yeah. And Dr. Southard, what about you?
Well, Jim, I actually think that I'm pretty hopeful. I think as a molecular biologist, I was always worried that what's going to happen with the next virus or bacteria. And, you know, we have together as a large community kind of started to win this battle over the last year. And it's been amazing to witness not just local, but the whole world coming together to create a vaccine in under a year. That's amazing. It's never been never happened, you know, in the history of mankind. And I think just speaks to the future of our, you know, of the human race, that we can accomplish a lot together. And so I'm overall pretty hopeful.
And Dr. Southard, we only have about 2 minutes left, but I think you brought up a really important point, which is that the world came together to create this vaccine, hence why it's happened so quickly, because I think there's so much concern about how can a vaccine actually work and be effective in that short amount of time.
Yeah, and I think there's some hesitancy for some people about how fast it came on board, but it, all the safety and studies and the scientific process that has created all other vaccines essentially we did the same thing. We just did it in a shorter time period because we put more resources to it. And so that to me just again speaks to the power of the human condition, what we can do when we come together.
Yeah, Gemma, what slows down vaccine development, one is funding, and we just poured a tremendous amount of funding into this. And two is enrollment, getting people to volunteer and sign up to get vaccinated. And those were two challenges that we didn't have this time. So those are two things that really accelerated our ability to generate this vaccine.
Well, and I really appreciate that clarification. I think it's so important for people that are hesitant and to understand the facts versus what you may have heard. Thank you both so very much for your time. I know it's hard to get away, so we really do appreciate all that you were doing and also coming on here. We've been talking with Dr. Rob Kavanaugh, St. Luke's Executive Medical Director, and Dr. Andrew Southard, Emergency Medical Director at St. Alphonsus. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Gemma.
And of course, we will have our medical experts back on next Wednesday. So if you have an email, a question, email us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Our producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. I'm Gemma Gaudet. It's Wednesday. It is, the sun is shining. It's a little cold out there, but it's a lovely day. I hope you can find some time to take care of yourself today. We'll see you back here tomorrow.